8. Rooftop Pursuit. A cloud of cold mist hung over London's rooftops and drizzled onto Modo's back. His large, wet hands were clamped around the edge of the roof, and he stared down on the city like a gargoyle, rarely blinking. Drops collected on his wide brow and trickled down his face, dripping off his crooked nose. Tharpa had taught him how to remain completely still, even to slow his heart rate. The mask hanging from his belt was black, his night mask. He didn't wear it unless he had to, because when he was jumping from rooftop to rooftop, it would sometimes slip and cover his eyes. The night he had nearly smashed his skull open on a crossbeam, he learned a valuable lesson. Directly below, flickering gaslights cast odd shadows across a courtyard. A figure in a frock coat appeared on the far side of the yard and walked toward him. As the man got closer, his pale face became clear. Modo cracked a thin smile. He'd been following Oscar Featherstone for over an hour, from his home in Highgate to this rooftop above the fancy shops and row houses of Marylebone. When Oscar caught a cab in Highgate, Modo had been forced to leap from roof to roof in pursuit, working up a terrible sweat. Now Oscar walked past him and through an archway. Modo froze for a few more moments, then scrambled across the shingles, his short bow legs surprisingly well suited to the steep slopes and changing angles. He leapt, his haversack swinging at his shoulder, and landed near the top of another roof, grasping a lightning rod to steady himself. A startled pigeon flew into the fog. His target was walking down an alley, so Modo bounded silently alongside and above him, stifling a chuckle. The young gentleman had no idea he was being trailed. Ever since Mr. Socrates dropped him in the middle of London, Modo had learned to use rooftops to his advantage. In the first frightening minutes after the carriage had pulled away, he'd scampered down several streets, darted through crowds, and finally, startled by the sight of a miserable drunk and his vicious dog, leapt up to a rooftop and huddled in a recess. From there, he watched the day unfold. Finally, when night fell again, he crept across the shingles, lapping up grey water from an eaves trough, and reaching through a window to steal a pork pie. By the third day, he was confident enough to return to the street, shifting his face into that of a young, handsome man. He helped lift a carriage stuck in deep septic mud and received a penny for his trouble. Soon he found other jobs that required his unusual strength. He slept in Hyde Park at night until the police shooed him off. Then he moved to a manure-rich stable. He squirreled his money away until he could afford a lice-infested room and a hot meal. At night he would take to the rooftops and watch the Londoners, the furtive movements of young ruffians who pickpocketed gentlemen on their way to the opera, women with impossible hats and beautiful faces out for tea, bobbies on their patrols, clutching their truncheons, the brawlers shouting near the pubs. On the roofs he was safe and could observe much more than most anyone else in the city. Once he watched a lower-class family walk to church. Their shabby clothes and shoes and tired eyes made him wonder if he was lucky to have been raised in Ravenscroft. Did Mr. Socrates save me from this sort of pauper life? But when the father put a hand on the son's shoulder, a lump had risen in Modo's throat. It was a dog that had led him down the path to his current work as a detective. From a rooftop, he'd spotted a trim white hound with an ornate collar. It had leapt a low wall and was trapped in a blind alley. Modo heard the dog's owner call for it. Modo dropped down to the alley and, thankfully, found the dog to be friendly. He still smiled when he recalled how it had licked his hand. He led it to his master and was paid threepence. He was inspired to place small notices in the Times, advertising "Lost Things Found," under the name Wellington. He thought people would trust the name. The Duke of Wellington had been a war hero, after all. Soon there were many requests for his services, people needing help to find everything from the mundane, wallet and walking canes, to the curious, a highly praised violin and a wooden leg. In a matter of weeks, Modo was able to move into the Red Boar, taking a room on the top floor with a coal stove and easy access to the roof. He'd spent nearly every night of the past 6 months on these rooftops. They belonged to him now, the only place he felt free. He had each dormer and slanting surface memorized. He could get from his room to Trafalgar Square faster than any cab. And what made it all so easy was that Londoners never looked up. They were always watching the cobblestones or hunching under umbrellas. But tonight, as he trailed Oscar Featherstone across Baker Street, Modo sensed he had moved up in the world. In this assignment, he felt a certain prestige. No more searching for lost wallets. Now he was on a case. He was a real detective. This is what he'd been trained for. It had been relatively simple to follow Oscar from his manor. The real test would be whether or not Modo could uncover what had been keeping the man up so late at night and frightening his sister so. His sister. Audrette. The thought of her name made Modo feel warm on a cold night, and yes, even giddy. She was so lovely, and spoke with angelic eloquence. He pictured the way she'd dabbed at her eyes with the handkerchief. He had memorized the moment, so tragic, sad, and at the same time so beautiful. His heart was racing uncomfortably, and he nearly lost his grip on the shingles. "Don't get addled, Modo," he whispered angrily, adjusting his haversack so that it sat squarely on his humped back. He crept along the rooftop until Oscar turned off the street and passed through an iron gate. At a two-story brick house, Oscar knocked on the door. The silhouette of the person who answered filled the doorframe, so Modo deduced it was a man. The hulking figure stepped aside so that Oscar could enter the house. The door closed. Modo surveyed the area. The roof of the house was too high and too far away for him to swing onto it. The stone wall surrounding the yard wasn't in good shape, sections crumbling here and there. But between him and the house, in the middle of the yard, sat an old gazebo that would likely support his weight. Modo ran quietly to the edge of the rooftop and launched himself toward the gazebo, taking a few branches off the oak tree as he flew through the air. He landed on the structure's rounded roof with a thud, and immediately bounced from there to a large balcony directly above the front door of the house. He'd tried to land lightly, but he'd made far too much noise, so he hid in a corner next to the drainpipe and waited until he was sure no one would come out looking. Tharper would have been proud to see how he was putting his teachings into practice, except, perhaps, for that jump. He padded to the edge of the balcony and removed his bendable spyglass from his haversack. It had taken great patience and many hours to create the instrument, reshaping and joining two spyglasses with his large-knuckled, fumbling fingers. He extended his invention and put the eyepiece up to his right eye. He lowered the other end over the side of the balcony until he was looking into a dirty window pane. The angle wasn't perfect, and the fisheye lens distorted the view even more. Nonetheless, soon Modo got his bearings and slowly scanned the room. He could make out Oscar talking to a man who had his back to the window. The man was tall, his immense shoulders stuffed into a suit coat, his hair black as coal. Modo watched them until the man walked away from the window, opened a door, and ushered Oscar into another room, out of Modo's sight. Now the best way to find out what Oscar was up to would be to get inside the house. He could easily break in through the balcony door, but he had no idea what or who was on the other side. It would be much more logical to walk in through the front door. That would require a transformation. He backed up into the corner of the balcony again. "You will always be ugly," Mr. Socrates had regularly reminded him over the years. "Always. But you are better able to adapt than any chameleon. Be thankful for it." At the moment, Modo was feeling anything but thankful as he checked his pocket watch, then turned his will to altering his body. Fire burned in his veins as his bones shifted in their sockets. He'd performed this adaptive transformation, as Mr. Socrates called it, thousands of times. He had worked to perfect each change. He closed his eyes, grimacing, picturing the man he wanted to look like. He chose an appearance inspired by a sketch of Peterkin, a favourite character from the novel The Coral Island. Mrs. Finchley had allowed him to read it, but he had to promise to hide the book whenever Mr. Socrates visited. Modo's facial plates shifted and became angular, his skin stretching smoothly across his new skull and straightened nose. His arms became thinner and longer, his chest smaller. And finally he turned his will to the hump, the dreadful hump. He forced it to sink into his flesh. He picked up his pocket watch. 3 minutes. Mr. Socrates would have been pleased. Sweating and tired, Modo patted his face to be sure he hadn't missed any unsightly lumps. He could only hold this shape for 5 hours at the most. Then his muscles would grow weak, and he'd slip back into his natural, repulsive self. His clothing looked ridiculous on this new, thin frame, so he took another cautious look around and stripped to his underclothes. Out of his haversack he pulled a set of fine breeches and yanked them on, followed by a shirt and a shawl-coloured vest. He tied a brown cravat around his neck, slipped on good shoes and a frock coat. He stuffed his mask under his old clothes in the haversack and left the bag in the shadows. Using bricks and the drain spout for support, Modo climbed down the wall. After ensuring his clothes were on straight, he stepped nonchalantly to the front door, took a good, deep breath, and knocked.